Welcome in, full-time report from 92.9 The Game and Odyssey here in Atlanta. This is a little different full-time report. It is not Atlanta United. It is U.S. Men's National Team, and it was not a good report from Mercedes-Benz Stadium this afternoon. The U.S. Men's National Team losing 5-2 to Belgium in a exhibition match. I'm not going to use the friendly word because Pochettino will get very upset about it. It wasn't much of an exhibition, or it wasn't very friendly. Both apply here because it wasn't a great match. There are talking points out of it. I do think there is the easy thing to just say, everything was bad, everything sucks. It's not that simple. It never is. We've been through this before, this crew, when we talk about other teams as well. It's me. I'm Jason Longshore. It's Madison Cruz. It's John Nelson. They were in the building. I want to ask and start with both of them. And Maddie, you're up first. How did it feel first when the U.S. took the lead? And then how did it feel when Belgium not just took the lead, but I think the third goal is where it felt like it changed?
Well, when the first goal happened, I mean, it was electric. I mean, I felt it even from the press box. I think you had around 66,000 fans in attendance for this. That's amazing. Atlanta showed out. That was incredible. You felt like the energy in the room and the cheers were incredible. I mean, it's a beautiful finish from Weston McKennie, first of all. Like, I watched it at least three times. I think I turned to John and I was like, wow, that's what Juventus is paying him for. And he's delivering every time, seriously. And it's why I think when you look at who can take that place and be someone like Christian Pulisic, who can be the star and take those moments on his own, Weston McKennie can do it because of what he just did in that first goal. I think it was a class finish. It was perfect, right place where he needed to be. It was electric. And then I think when Belgium took over, especially with that third goal, I think Doku is incredible. I mean, you know him from Man City and what he's able to do. I mean, he's outstanding, and he was able to work, especially on that left side, and get things done. I think when Belgium took, I agree with you. I think it really started to turn, I think around the third goal for Belgium. And I mean, it just kind of felt just like a little deflated a little bit with it, but because it's unfortunate. Because I agree with Pochettino. I think that the team played really well in the first half. I think they played really, really good. I thought it was a very back and forth game, and it was really even, especially obviously when Belgium took the tie going into the halftime. I thought it was really even, and I was really excited to see the second half. And it kind of just felt like the U.S. had the moments, and we talk about it a lot on AST and on SDH. All three of us have talked about it on multiple different platforms about control in a match and momentum in a match. And the U.S. had more possession in the game, but Belgium took control of the moments in the match when it mattered. They took control of those elements. They were able to take control of their chances. They were able to capitalize on those moments, and they got the job done, and they were able to cling on to it, and they were able to win it, and they were able to steal it from the U.S.
The possession's really skewed, in my opinion, because the first half, where I thought the U.S. was better, they only had 41% of the ball. Second half, I think once Belgium took the lead, they sat back a little bit more. But, John, you look at the big chances, and the U.S. had two in the first half. Belgium had none. Second half, it was Belgium 3-1. So that means, overall, big chances were 3-3, which gives you a little bit different vibe of this game. I mean, total shots, yes, 21-12, but 16 shots off target for Belgium. It's a weird game to try to get a feel for control, dominance, momentum, all of those different things, because I don't know if it followed a straight narrative.
And you also got to see Senne Lammens come up big in a couple of moments. Mm-hmm. There was the point blank shot that I think it actually was Weston McKennie. It was, I'm trying to look at my notes here quickly. It was where he had the point blank save, and basically Lammens is going one way completely, 17th minute.
Yeah.
And it's off a corner, and you saw the United States separately, you know, quickly taking advantage of set pieces. On a couple of corners, they were dangerous, but they didn't quite convert. 17th minute, you had that opportunity for the United States where Lammens comes up big. He came up big on a couple of occasions in the first 40 minutes or so. And if you put those chances in the back of the net, then we're talking about game state. And we're talking about the game being different entirely. So there were moments in the first half that weren't converted. Keepers came up big. Matt Turner came up big with a couple of saves as well in the first 40 minutes or so. So I think to your point about having the even chances, you know, over the full 90 minutes at 3-3, you had keepers come up big. For the United States, it wasn't finishing chances in that first 40 and 45, and then you end up with that equalizer late in the first half that sends everybody to the locker room at 1-1, and you mentioned being deflating. Obviously, you're standing with Belgium in that first 40 and 45 minutes, and then you get that goal right there at the end of the half, and it gives you something to think about heading into the locker room. But, yeah, the game had runs and fits, and you saw the U.S. early on taking advantage of going, you know, over the top and going long with the speed down the left and the right wings, and you saw them trying to take advantage of things there. They went away from that when Belgium adjusted, and so there was a lot of give and take and a bunch of different elements here in this match.
I have two things that were troubling in this match. Let's start with structure a little bit, and we talked about this on AST from Reverb this afternoon, Maddie. We weren't sure what the lineup was going to look like. I thought that Pochettino would stick with three center backs and Tessman would drop to the back line. It was much more of a line of four. And I think the question to Pochettino in the press conference afterwards was maybe somewhere kind of lost in translation both ways. I don't know if it kind of got across properly. I feel like this team right now is better with the help that Pochettino talked about, the help not arriving for Doku, who was electric the whole game. You weren't getting the help for Tim Weah. Okay, I feel like this team kind of solved that issue by playing three center backs before and having more help from deeper. Maybe this is a little bit of a lesson that, hey, the reactions aren't going to be quite quick enough, so you're going to need to have that help be from a deeper position, because, you know, we saw this team kind of shift to that in the fall last year. And whether it was three true center backs or kind of the hybrid where you'd have somebody who was really a fullback playing as a center back, but they defended as a center back, I think this is where it got confusing in the postgame conversation. You didn't have that today, and it showed, because I don't think the team looked strong enough defensively in the key moments.
Yeah, and what Mauricio was talking about, and I did see it, because I remember writing it down, and I remember seeing it too. When the team was building up, you saw Cardoso, you saw Tessman drop back into that line.
Yeah, that's different. That's different, though. That's a whole different conversation. And I feel like this is where, like, formation and shape, everybody gets, like, wildly bent out of shape about it, because there's really two shapes you got to think about, like, when you have the ball and when you don't have the ball. I'm talking purely when you don't have the ball defensively. You didn't see the third center back, and I think what Pochettino wanted was for a midfielder to come help when Tim Weah got 1v1 with Doku and it was late to arrive. I think they're probably better suited to not ask the midfielder to come help, but to have an extra center back behind the wing back or the fullback in that situation.
And you kind of took the words out of my mouth, because that was what I was going to say afterwards.
I read your mind sometimes.
But listen, I think when you saw it in the buildup too, because you want to get the numbers forward, in the back line when you saw it shift back, when they didn't have the ball, because this is what he talked about in the press conference, and that's where I think, especially with the question, how it got lost in translation, when he was trying to explain it, is where it got a little bit confusing. But that's what he was trying to explain in that situation. That's what he was trying to go at with it. And that's where I was trying to explain it as well before you read my mind. But as we keep going, especially in that back line, though, I agree. Because when you look especially what was happening with Doku on the left and with Tim Weah trying to defend on that side too, Doku's a problem. And that's where you did need someone like a Tessman, like Cardoso, coming back to drop. And you saw it a couple times in the first half. I saw it. Weston McKennie would drop back onto that right side a lot and would help in that buildup too. You would see him drop to help defend in those situations. I watched a play immediately where I saw him right there. He saw what was happening, and he immediately dropped in on that right side to help defend with the U.S. And that's what you needed to see. You needed to see that help come in, especially for Tim Weah, who's not traditionally a defender on that side. He's traditionally someone that gets forward as well. You wanted that extra help there, especially closing down someone like Doku and what he can do on that left side. And it's trial and error. I don't think it's not raising the warning bells just yet. I think it's something that this team just needs to learn from and take it and absorb it. And then when you go and you get ready for Portugal on Tuesday – you know, next time, okay, yeah, I don't need to do that again. This is what we need to do. This is how we fix the problem.
Yeah, I feel like maybe this is the reinforcement that this team just isn't structured to be able to play a line of four when they defend. I think they need the 3/5 when they defend. John, what else stood out to you? You had a chance to hang out in the mix zone and hear from players. What stood out to you?
What Timothy Weah was one of them. To the point that we've been discussing here, he had mentioned post-match that the game plan against Doku was to double-team him as much as possible and try to pin him against the touchline. And you saw what happened when Weah wasn't getting the help that was supposed to be there at moments.
Yeah, but here's the thing for me. Like when you look at it and you start to map it out, okay, if you want to push him to the touchline and you want to double, which I'm fine with, I think that's absolutely, you want to use the touchline as an extra defender, you want to squeeze him, you're asking Tesman or Cardoso to make a long run over to get into that position rather than almost have two layers to it and have three center backs. So instead of Tim being solo with Doku, and then it's McKenzie who would have to come over and slide to try to make the play, you have that extra center back that's closer. It just feels like they got better in terms of the structure defensively. And maybe you try this because of the center back injuries. And that absolutely could be it, because like we said today, Maddie, this result doesn't matter. You have to take what you learned here and make it matter in the summer, because ultimately this game doesn't count for anything. It doesn't look good, and it changes the vibes and it changes the momentum I think the team has, but you've got to take lessons out of this. And I think the lesson is you need to have three center backs when you defend.
I agree. I think when you're looking at, especially when it comes to double teaming Doku in that situation too, you could have also seen, because you saw it a little bit too, when you were trying to shift back a little bit, you saw Cardoso and Tesman, maybe you wanted them to slot in and almost create that three center back to then allow for maybe McKenzie to come over and shift to help with that push that way. That way you're getting those numbers there too. But again, It didn't look organized. And that's the issue. Like that would have been the other thing too. That way, when you shift that way, you get that extra man back there. That way, then you can push him to the touchline there. But again, it wasn't organized, so you didn't see that. And that's where the issue comes into play. And that's where, when you're looking ahead to Portugal, that organization needs to be better. And the communication has to be better, too, of where you're going to go, where things are going to go in that situation.
Well, different structure, too. And Portugal's got different challenges that they'll present. They don't have a Jeremy Doku, thankfully. Doku is one of the best wingers in the world. I think if anything we take away from the opponent, John, is Belgium. You know, we've talked about them over the years. I think they were ranked number one in the FIFA rankings unfairly for a while when they really hadn't won anything. And then maybe they got punished for the algorithms putting them higher than they should have been. And it felt like they dropped. This is a good team. And this is a team that isn't fully over the golden generation, because you still have a guy like Kevin De Bruyne who is great, and I think Lukaku will be there in the World Cup. But when you're starting to add these young players mixed in, Belgium, to me, I take more away to give Belgium props than feel like the U.S. is different than I thought they were coming in.
Yeah, and you know, you look at a De Ketelaer, and there were a lot and Salamakers and Amadou Onana that was a part of this too.
Luka Bakio. I mean,
yeah, Luka
Bakio. He was really good.
Yeah, and you know, you bring in Luka Bakio, and this, remember, this was a side that, to your point, did not have Romelu Lukaku, did not have Leandro Trossard as a part of this group that was out there this afternoon going up against the United States. And you know, you look at how they were able to, and Kevin De Bruyne had one of the quietest games, but that's once again when you sit there and it's like, oh, by the way, Kevin De Bruyne was there and he did ABCDE, and he's like, man, that was a really quiet performance.
When you're quiet and you have three key passes, I will take that all day long.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I think that there's a lot to take from this in this matchup against a Belgium team that has your veterans and is bringing in those younger players and is having this duel in net with Matsels and Sene Lammers. And they're trying to figure out who's going to be between the sticks. But when you get to have that kind of a battle where it's a 1A and a 1B, that's never a bad thing to have for your future either. And one other thing that stuck with me in the mix zone was when Rudy Garcia was asked about the result, as was Mauricio Pochettino. Rudy Garcia, the manager for Belgium said that the margin does not determine the kind of team and the kind of match that we had, because he was looking at it basically in two separate sections. Everything that happened to the 60th minute, and then from the 60th minute to the 90th minute, where you had six substitutions, I believe, for Mauricio Pochettino in two windows after the 60th minute. And so Rudy Garcia wasn't really buying the whole idea that 5-2 was the truest of true results here. He knows that the U.S. is better than that 5-2, and he had some extenuating circumstances and things that were in his mind as to how it ended up the way that it did. So that was one of the other things that stuck with me from a Rudy Garcia perspective. Christian Pulisic was more than happy to just kind of sit there and take the result and move on from it in the sense of, yes, there's stuff to learn from, but he wasn't going to be hung up on it. And neither was Ricardo Pepi in his conversations, and Tim Weah across the board. Everybody that came into the mix zone, they're like, okay, we got stuff we can learn from here. We're not going to, you know, hang our heads about it, but we're going to learn from it and go forward to see what's going to happen against Portugal on Tuesday.
Yeah, Pochettino called a reality check, and I agree, but I'll separate the game into three. Mm-hmm. And the middle portion is my other troubling element to this day. Started well, and we can put it to 30, 35, 40, wherever you draw the line. The U.S. was pretty good in the early going, very even with Belgium, maybe slightly better. Again, the big chances tell you they were slightly better. Okay, it was the end of the first half with that first goal through, the 68th when the fourth goal happened. That's a lot of goals in a short period of time.
Yeah.
And I very specifically remember, Maddie, sitting with you at the brew house in the last friendly before the Gold Cup last summer, where game got out of hand and it had been back-to-back games that had gotten out of hand, and the team gave up a bunch of goals in a short period of time. And that felt like it had been corrected. This scares me because it was not, and they let the game get away from them. And that was before all the subs started happening too.
Yeah, and it's where you start to question a little bit too. And I think as well, Pochettino talked about it in media too. I mean, this is a team that you want to have the intensity every time you go out there. Something I think for the USA, listen, you're going to go up against a lot of really strong opponents with a lot of really good talent. But for the US, you are a team that is intense, and you want that to be the branding. You want that intensity to show in every single moment. And Pochettino talked about it, is that sometimes you didn't see it on both ends, and you have to see it more consistently throughout 90 minutes. And you saw it in flashes, but you didn't see it consistently. That needs to change. But especially when you look at the World Cup going forward, especially when you look at that match against Portugal too, it's about making that consistent all the way through. And that consistency has to show. And the fact that in those moments, especially with the intensity, especially with those moments about letting in a lot of those goals, that can't happen. That it just can't. I mean, you look at the second goal. I believe it was the second goal, and there was a lot of goals scored. So I could be wrong. Could be very wrong. If it's wrong, you guys will let me know. But it's one where it was wide open, especially right at the top of the 18.
Oh, the Onana goal.
Yes. Wide open right at the top of the 18. And Pochettino mentioned that one specifically and said that just no one was there. Everyone was bunched into one side. Nobody was even watching. That can't happen. There has to be a little bit more of that awareness, especially more of that recognition of where things are. And it can't all just be bunched to one side. You have to make sure that you are organizing, that there is somebody there watching every player in the 18, making sure someone is at least marking or at least knowing, oh, hey, I see something over here. I got to make sure I'm at least in a right position to stop this shot or get in the way to make sure that they don't have enough of a look of a shot to even find something. And that's where I'm concerned with, especially in those moments defensively, but also I think the intensity too. I felt like at moments, I agree with them. There were moments where you saw that intensity. You saw those moments and you were like, oh yes, this is the team you want to see. You want teams to come in to face the U.S. being scared of that intensity. Because it was something we talked about before, especially on AST today, in parentheses, talking about Belgium and how they would manage that intensity. Because a lot of times, especially when we've seen Belgium, they play a lot of teams that are a little bit lower than them. So how would they go up against a team like the U.S.? They handle themselves very well. But I do think it is, too. The U.S. is a better team than what the results showed, and that's what Rudy Garcia also said. And I agree with them, too. I think that as well. But I think, again, Belgium took control of the moments where they had them. They were able to capitalize on the moments where they had it, and they got the job done. The USA had those moments. They just didn't capitalize. And you need to see that intensity and that intensity be consistent all the way through the match.
Yeah, Belgium didn't have the ups and downs in intensity. I think the U.S. Yes. had it early where they were at least matching Belgium's intensity. I don't know if I'd say Belgium was like overly out, you know, being more intense. Like, I don't know if I'd say that. I think they were better in moments, but there were moments where it was obvious that the U.S. intensity dropped, and it was when things weren't going well. And that's a concern. I think there were players who didn't necessarily help themselves in this match, and you don't have a lot of time to fix that. I'm really curious to see what Pochettino does on Tuesday, because he's probably going to have mostly the same group. It doesn't sound like anybody came out of it with any injury concerns. I don't know if there was anybody who was on kind of a minutes restriction coming into these two games. I think McKennie looked good. I think, you know, Adjiman gets a goal late. I think Pepe looked good. Your subs brought some energy, but you just had a lot of performances that weren't at the level they needed to be. I don't think Tim Ream had a great day, and we talked about it before. I think in a two center back pairing, I really worry about Ream. I worry about the lack of pace. I think you kind of saw him not look as secure today, and that's why I kind of keep going back to the three center back idea, the way you defend, because I feel like it gives security, which then gives you more comfort in being more intense and taking more chances and being more aggressive. And I think when you don't have that, you get these moments where it feels very indecisive. And that's kind of when this game turned, was when it felt that way. And the U.S. felt like they were on their back foot, and Belgium just kept playing and kept feeding Doku. And Tim Weah had moments against Doku, but Doku had the bigger moments. I don't think Weah was terrible against Doku, but look, this is how these games go, John. Like, you get judged by what happens in those giant moments. You can shut somebody down in 5 of 8 dribbles. And I think Weah was like 50-50 on his duels, which is fine. But Doku created 3 chances, and I think he was the source of danger most of the day.
Yep. I'm trying to check the defensive stats here quickly for Weah. 4 defensive contributions, 1 for 3, 3 for 6 on his ground duels. So there you go. He was 50-50 on his duels. But, you know, I think we are kind of predisposed to look at, you know, just as an example. Okay, so he was 3 for 6 in success rate. Then what happened in the 3 where he wasn't successful? And you're kind of, you know, pinned into that. Sadly, that idea of looking at what wasn't successful as opposed to what was, and we're locked into those big moments of when something isn't, unsuccessful.
You have to be. No. That's the thing, is this isn't, we're not talking about a player's performance over a whole season. We're talking about a season that's going to be 3 games, 3 group stage games in a World Cup, and 1 mistake like you saw from Tim Ream, 1 mistake like you saw from Sebastian Berhalter, 1 mistake you saw from a Max Arston, those are the moments that can send you home.
Yep.
So, like, that's where you get into this conversation for Pochettino of who's not going to make the big mistakes. And if the big mistakes happen, then who's going to go and make a play the other way to make up for a mistake?
Yep.
And I don't think we have any answers to that yet. I do think we have to keep in mind, like, the big picture here. Belgium's a top 10 team. The U.S. is a top 20 team. I think you saw that difference today, even though the U.S. had the home field advantage, and it sounded great in the bends. It felt like the home field really gave them a boost for a while. But we've also seen this at the bends, where that home field gives you a boost, and then things start to go the other way. And it's eerie when it gets quiet.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's unsettling for teams, home teams.
When it went to 3, and especially in and around what happened involving the PK, and
it was weird.
It was bizarre. Maddie and I, we were going back and forth as to what was going on, since there wasn't a whole lot of communication in the building. We're having to try and extrapolate what's going on off of monitors, and she and I are looking at what's going on. Okay, we see it here. I see this angle here, and you're not really getting any kind of an explanation. And
they had one replay where I felt like, okay, I see what the ref called, because the ref called PK on the field. And I do think it hits Reem's hand, and his arm's away from his body. So, like, the body position, definitely you can call the handball. I don't think it hit it hard or any, you know, significant way, but I think it did because it looked like it went down and spun a little bit.
Yeah.
It wasn't clear either way. So, ultimately, like, the VAR saw something to say, I don't think it hit his hand, and sent it down for a look. I didn't necessarily get that clear look that it didn't hit his hand on when I watched the replay. So
I thought
I saw directly behind where you didn't see the ball turn. And this was like literally over Turner's left shoulder and looking right at Reem's back. And you see it kind of go in between. And it's a shot from behind. Yeah. And I didn't see anything change in rotation. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, well, he didn't touch it. They didn't go back to that angle, which I also thought was confusing in the television production.
Yeah. See, I saw one angle. I think it's the other way where it looks like the ball is on a trajectory. And then where you can't quite see where it would hit his arm, it looks like it goes down.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, it hit his arm. But then you couldn't quite tell.
Yeah, and then for me, like, it's the conversation that we have all the time when we talk about VAR and when we talk about referees, too. Referee made a decision on call said penalty. He gets called to VAR to go look at it. They take a look at it. He sticks with his decision and says penalty.
Yep.
Listen, I'm completely fine with that. I would rather you take a look at it, especially if it's not clear and obvious.
Yeah.
You take a look at it, you're looking at the replays. If you don't think it's clear and obvious that there was an error that you made and that it's not a handball on Reem, then you don't change it. And I think Pochettino talked about it in media as well. He was confused, especially as to why I think it wasn't called back, especially when he went to VAR for it. And like normally, again, too,
I get that.
I understand that, too, because I sometimes complain about that as well. I do think, though, that the referee in this decision made the right call in going and looking at it, getting that extra look, but being like, you know what? There's nothing for I don't see anything for me to overturn it. I'm going to keep the decision. It's a penalty.
I couldn't tell that it clearly did not hit his hand from the replay. So I think I saw enough to think that it did, at least in one of the angles. So I think you stick with it. I would have loved to have heard the conversation with what the VAR told the referee to get him to go look at it, because he must have had some strong persuasive abilities to do that.
Yeah.
But it didn't ultimately get overruled. Anything else from today that stands out that we haven't talked about? I mean, we haven't talked about the kits. We'll finish there because that's just silliness. Anything else that we have not talked about to wrap up today?
Well, just to kind of put a bow on the point that we were just discussing, you mentioned how the air kind of came out of the building. I think it started with the PK and then the lingering of it. And then you go from, what, the 56th minute when it was called, and then the kettle air closes the deal in the 59th. Then you end up with Onana scoring in the 53rd, De Ketelaer scoring in the 59th, and then Luca Bacchio scores his first in the 68th. That's three goals in 15 minutes. 2 and 6, including the PK, and 3 and 15.
That's what concerns me.
And when you have something like that happen, how do you stop the quicksand? You know, that was the other thing, that spacing right there where it goes from 1-1, you come out, then it's 2, a PK, and 4. Boom, 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 like that with Luca Bacchio. And it's like I'm looking at quicksand moments and seeing how the USMNT responds. But yeah, the whole jersey thing. Goodness gracious.
Yeah, I mean, the last thing on the game for me is those moments. You call it quicksand. It's to me that's the difference between a top 10 team and a top 20 team.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we see this when you're talking about a league, for example, a mid-table team is going to be more volatile than a top-end team. A top-end team might get rattled, might have things go against them, might give up a goal, might give up two goals, but they don't give up a third. And that's where this team, and we saw it last summer and we saw it today, they got rattled, they were getting outplayed, and they didn't have the proper response until you had subs. And then subs brought some different energy, and there's a ton of subs, and it is what it is because, look, you've got one more international game for most teams around the world. And then you've got some of these players going straight into next weekend in league and then midweek in Champions League or in Europa League or in Conference League. So you've got to manage the minutes properly. You got to give managers a lot of subs to work with. But I have an issue with how they handled it when it got out of reach. And I wouldn't have as big of an issue with it if we hadn't seen it before. So that's something that's a concern. The jerseys were absolutely a concern. how this happens, I have no idea, because we know the teams talked because they agreed to have 11 subs.
Mm-hmm.
Did they not talk about what shirts they were wearing? Like, what are we doing?
I understand, especially to like, I get it. But I feel like that's where if you're the U.S., you're like, hey, it's in Atlanta. We're the home team. We're wearing our home kits. Like,
okay, so Adam Crafton over at The Athletic. Neither the USMNT nor Belgium had an alternative kit at the venue to change kits. Post-kickoff, they tried to source from the team hotels, but it wasn't possible. Amadou Onana from Belgium said it was awful on the field. Semi Lamans raised at the halftime with the kit man. Christian Pulisic said it was difficult to deal with. Matt Turner was asked about it, and he really didn't want to address it, and he said it really didn't have anything to do with the end result on the day.
Yeah, you don't want it to come off as an excuse, but it is absolutely a problem.
Yeah.
Like, look, yeah. if you're playing in a match, and I haven't played in a stadium that big, but when you're playing and things are chaotic and you pop your head up to try to see, you know, a long pass, or you're trying to pick up somebody making a run, and you just glance and you see all the same color shirt, basically.
Yeah.
Like, what? I mean, you have to start looking at the different color of shorts and the different color of socks, and that throws you off. That split second can make a big difference. Mm-hmm. It's extremely frustrating that this happens because, again, the teams communicated during the week. You have to know, okay, you're going to wear this. Okay, you're going to wear this. All right, cool. Then part two, the U.S. is playing in the same building on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't they have both kits in the building? Like, what, are you worried it's going to end up like disappearing? Freddy the Falcon's going to come in and take it? Like, what are we doing with this? Have both kits there.
Well, and according to Crafton, getting the Belgian view on this, the Belgians argue the onus had to be on the U.S. men's national team to wear the alternative Navy kit, as even Belgium's home red kit may have clashed with the red waves on the new USMNT.
Agree.
Yeah.
Nobody, including the match commissioner, according to Crafton, realized this before the game.
The match commissioner failed his assignment. The kit people, I think, on both teams, whatever communication that happened between the teams, maybe it's ops, maybe it's kit people, I don't know. There were failures, multiple.
Mm-hmm.
And just the fact that this happens, it's just one of those things that you see and you're like, guys, this is a big game with 66,000 people in the building and millions watching on TV around the world, and it looks bad.
Mm-hmm.
There's no excuse for it. It shouldn't happen.
Yeah, it does not look good. It is somewhere along the line of communication or what happened, it just fell. It fell through, especially too, I feel like it's one where it's frustrating because you know that there were conversations, especially about the substitutions, about all of that, and it didn't cross anybody's mind to maybe go, oh, hey, maybe we should talk about the kits because they are kind of similar, maybe.
I mean, you knew what they were. Like, if you're the U.S., I kind of do agree with Belgium in this case, because if you're the U.S., you know Belgium typically wears red. All right. Their other kit is publicized. You know what it is. You have to kind of say, like, hey, guys, which one are you planning on wearing? Can we get a comparison to make sure? Because we might need to wear our darker kits.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, it looked bad. It added to the frustration of the day. It did not cause the loss. Don't get me wrong. But were there moments where it could have caused indecision on the field? Absolutely. Because the kits were far too similar, and that should not happen. Hopefully that will happen with Portugal. Their red is a little darker. It's a little more maroonish. So if they wear that, I think you're okay. We'll see. They're wearing their maroonish kits. I don't know the proper color in Portuguese, so I'm probably not being fair. They're wearing that tonight in Mexico City as they face El Tri. They'll be making the trip up here to Atlanta to play Tuesday. It's at 7:00. We will not have anything pregame, but we will have a Monday night show from the Brewhouse Cafe from 7 to 9, where we'll talk a lot more about this. There will be a Match Day Minus One press conference earlier that day, and Maddie will be there, and Sophia Cupertino will be there, and they will have all the tea for us for the match and get us ready, because I am really curious to see what is said in that Match Day Minus One press conference after what we heard today.
Hold on. We're not ending this with you saying you said tea.
I did.
Uh-huh, he did.
I feel like I'm indoctrinating you both into the Gen Z language.
You can't really claim that one. That's kind of common these days. No, that's kind of common these days.
I don't know. When you guys say it, and Jarrett as well, he's a big thing of this too. When he'll say stuff in the group chat, I'm like, I'm scared. You guys are on social media more than I am. That's scary.
Oh, we are not on social media more than you.
Maybe. No, I probably am.
Yeah.
It's kind of part of what I do. So, you know, I do have to keep up with it. And yes, people talk about the tea on social media and it happens. We'll see what Pochettino's got to say about it. We'll talk about it on Monday from the Brew House, 7 to 9. You can watch it live. You can come hang out with us. You can have an Around the Corner lager. They're $5 pints right now. That's all cool. That'll be on SDH. And then Tuesday night after the game, we will have Atlanta Soccer Tonight, late night edition, starting at 11 o'clock. We're starting late because the last game of World Cup qualifying, the very last game, kicks off at 10:30. So by the time we shut down Atlanta Soccer Tonight, we will know who the 48th team is. If they go to extra time, if they go to penalties, we're staying on the air until we know who the 48th team is. It can't go that late. I mean, there's kind of a limit here. It's 90 minutes plus 30 and in a penalty shootout. So we might have one extra second.
Unless the penalty shootout goes to like its 10th round and we're just in like...
All right, we might have two extra segments.
We've seen those happen, but just not at that level.
We will see what happens, but we'll wrap up all of that on Tuesday. Make sure you're following all of us. Make sure you're subscribed to Off the Woodwork. Make sure you're subscribed to Soccer Down Here on your podcast platforms. And we'll have more coverage of the U.S. Men's National Team all week long on SDH and on 92.9 The Game. Adios, everybody.